Netherlands. This is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, fear and loathing in Doha. Merchants of Death and their state clients hobnob. An intrepid Canadian journalist captures it all on his smartphone.
It's absolutely grotesque. Devastating, awful, unjust wars all over the global south, in Africa, in other parts of the Middle East, and so forth. And here are these men acting as though they're on top of the world, wheeling and dealing, making gobs of money, smiling and laughing. And I just couldn't stomach the thought that they were profiting from the immense suffering that their industry is causing every minute of every day.
On the other side of the planet, in Ottawa, the Canadian military shops online for surveillance drones that can kill.
The government is thinking about this not just in the context of beneficial operations. Police in Canada are increasingly incorporating things like facial recognition technologies into their work, right? And when you couple that with domestic surveillance drones, things can get really scary, right? You very, very quickly.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Nothing like a huge bazaar. Who doesn't love wandering through a crowded food market or scouting out old vinyl or antiques in a packed convention hall bursting with merchants and awesome deals? How about an arms convention? Merchants of Death at every turn. Hawking surface-to-air missiles, armored personnel carriers, speedboats bristling with guns, and killer drones of all sizes. That's what the Doha International Maritime Defense Exhibition and Conference, or DIMDEX, offered up earlier this month in the Qatari capital. DIMDEX describes itself as a dynamic platform attended by key decision makers and industry leaders, showcasing state-of-the-art technologies and products, significant deals and partnerships. Merchants of Death is what Dimitri Lascaris calls them. Lascaris, a Canadian lawyer, activist, and journalist, is an intrepid follower of the arms industry. He attended DIMDEX, videoing the scene with color commentary on his smartphone. The GPM reached Dimitri Lascaris somewhere in the Middle East. Now, you attended this DIMDEX conference, which, I mean, to begin with, I was really struck by how technically proficient it was. It was very well shot. And, you know, I don't use a smartphone, truth be told. And I thought maybe you had something, you know, on your forehead, but because clearly you were getting good frames and all the while talking and, you know, just walking by and everybody was completely oblivious. And I was thinking, geez, I mean, you know, I wonder whether or not people are suspicious. But it is amusing, of course, to see people as you're walking by. There are other people with their smartphones filming things. And so tell me how you actually did it. I mean, you scoped the place out. You walked around first to figure out what was there, and then you started filming.
Well, I got there. The location of the exhibition was the Qatari National Convention Center. And it consists of 6 or 7 exhibition halls. And they're all adjacent to each other. And so they had opened the entire facility up so that it was one gigantic exhibition hall. And I walked in there and I saw, like, immediately it was apparent to me. I mean, this thing is several football fields. It was going to take me some time just to scope it out. And I didn't know whether photographing was permitted. And I didn't want to ask because I just was kind of concerned about drawing attention to myself. So I spent the first hour just roaming around this cavernous, monstrous facility, checking out what was going on. And I noticed that there were several people with very high caliber cameras filming. And these guys looked like professional photographers. They definitely weren't amateurs, just judging by the equipment that they had. So I thought, okay, clearly videotaping is not forbidden. So I pulled out my trusty iPhone 11 and stuck it on the end of one of those sticks. And, you know, it wasn't taped to my forehead. It was on a stick, and I was holding the stick. And I kept it close enough to me so that, you know, the the audio recording of my voice, you know, it would be sufficiently clear for people to understand what I was saying. And then I just started walking from one end to the other and commenting as I stumbled upon various things that I thought merited commentary.
I mean, you're a lawyer, of course. You're a top flight lawyer, so you talk very well and you articulate very well. And but as you were walking along, you were talking really articulately. You didn't pause and search for a way to describe what you were seeing. And you were describing what you were seeing, and you obviously are knowledgeable about all this military hardware. How are you so knowledgeable about all this military hardware? I mean, you were talking about surface to air. Oh, there's a surface to air missile. There's a quadcopter. Well, they're obvious. There's there's a radar device. There's obviously a little, and they were very strange machines. The one that looked like a cross between a skidoo and a helicopter.
So I'm certainly no military expert, but I know a lot more now about military technologies and military tactics and operational considerations than I did when the Ukraine war began. When the Ukraine war began, because I immediately became skeptical, I was very concerned about the possibility of this war escalating to a nuclear conflict. That was my primary motivation for speaking out about this, as I did, with, you know, at considerable reputational expense from the very beginning. But I, one of the elements of the narrative, the mainstream narrative, that I thought, based upon what I was hearing from some skeptics who have military expertise, was that Ukraine was destined to lose. And I thought, that's very interesting, because what we're hearing is that Russia is going to lose this war. So I took a lot of time and energy in the last 2 years, just because I was very concerned about this war and where it was all heading, to try and gain a basic understanding of military matters. And again, even after 2 years, I probably spent hundreds of hours listening to military experts, reading military analyses by top-notch military experts, reading technical analyses of weaponry. I probably spent hundreds of hours doing that in the last 2 years. So now I think I have a basic understanding. I probably have a better understanding than the average non-military citizen. But I'm no expert, David, you know, and so I was just applying in that conversation what I've come to understand about the arsenals of NATO countries and the Russian Federation in the course of studying this war.
And what I found amusing as you were going along talking about giving a tour to everybody of this arms bazaar and providing color commentary, and with people walking by, and there were like sheikhs walking by and exquisitely suited, white-suited naval officers. This was a naval weapons bazaar. And so there were a lot of, I guess, Qatari and other Middle Eastern naval types, officers in white, looking very natty, and also people in business suits. And you were just going on and providing commentary and constantly going, oh, look at this. Look at all these merchants of death. Look at this killing machine. Look at this genocidal device. And I'm thinking, is anybody listening to what you're saying?
Well, that's why I was keeping the phone reasonably close to my mouth, because I was concerned that somebody would hear what I was saying and I was going to get my ass unceremoniously tossed out of there. As far as I know, nobody did hear what I was saying. People were off in their own world selling their machines of killing death and so forth. But it's interesting, you know, after spending an hour walking around that weapons bazaar, and before beginning the videotaping, I stopped and I reflected, just like we do, any of us who, you know, spend a lot of time doing public speaking, what is the tone of my conversation going to be? And I decided that I was going to let fly with my personal feelings about the military industrial complex, and I wasn't going to pull any punches. It wasn't going to be some dry technical analysis. I was going to let my audience know how I feel about this, and how I feel about what I saw there that day was that it's absolutely grotesque. It's absolutely grotesque. There was a genocide happening, as I mentioned several times during the video, not to mention an existentially dangerous war in Ukraine, plus, you know, devastating, awful, unjust wars all over the global South, in Africa, in other parts of the Middle East and so forth. And here are these men, you know, acting as though they're on top of the world, you know, wheeling and dealing, making gobs of money, smiling and laughing. And I just couldn't stomach the thought that they were profiting from the immense suffering that their industry is causing every minute of every day.
Yeah, and these are all people who are perfectly, you know, I guess, ordinary, you know, people living banal lives with families and kids, and they're decent, warm-hearted, you know, breadwinners and with neighbors and families and of various religious faiths. Were there any Israeli people there?
Not that I could tell. I did not see, you know, there may well have been, but they were being discreet. That's possible. It's also possible there were Canadian officials there, but that they too were being discreet. I did not, I looked specifically for people who, you know, representatives of the Israeli military or government or the Israeli military contractors and Canadians. And I never saw anybody who appeared to me to be either of those things. But there were a lot of Americans conspicuously holding out that they were American. And there were a lot of Brits and Germans and French. Those four groups were very, very conspicuous on the exhibition floor. They had no qualms about letting people know that they were from, you know, whatever country they were from. The others were being, I think, significantly more discreet.
But I mean, I don't know if you know who Rosalie Bertel was. Rosalie Bertel was an American-Canadian peace activist, nuclear health researcher, Grey Nun, a member of the Order of Grey Nuns, who passed away some years ago. Do you know who Rosalie Bertel was?
I've heard the name, but you've
Institute,
told me more
International
about
Institute, International Institute of Public Health. And she, right. I remember a story of hers talking to her, and she shared the story around, was going to a conference or a, you know, back in the 1970s, where there were all these arms control types, arms control, it's kind of like an oxymoron, arms control types talking about, as she described it, MIRVs and MARVs and multiple reentry vehicles and Trident missiles and the rest of it. And these were all people, you know, engaged in not manufacturing them, but in arming their armies with them and equipping their countries with them. And she finally got a chance to speak, and she asked in her, you know, inimical voice, which was very kind of quiet and grandmotherly. How many people do you think have died as a result of the equipment that you talk about in your building? Like, how many have died around the world? Can you put a number on that? And Paul Warnke, as she described the situation, the famous American chief of arms control in the States in the 1970s, Paul Warnke, finally, a bit uncomfortably, it seemed it was his responsibility to answer, and he said, "That's not our department."
Oh my God. That's probably what I would have expected one of these people to answer if they had been inclined to do so.
And of course, it was a bit self-consciously acknowledging that what she had raised was a valid point, but that's not their department. So it's walking through this place, I'm sure you must have thought, holy crow, right? I mean, how many people die as a result of, and are dying as a result of all these pieces of equipment? Some of them are huge, like armored personnel carriers with missile launchers on the top. And
yeah, and it's not just, David, the direct casualties that these instruments of death cause. The money that is spent on them is being diverted from socially useful purposes that save lives and make lives better, that lift people out of poverty, that, you know, strengthen our healthcare system, that, you know, increase security for the population and you know, negate threats of violence directed at vulnerable constituencies. So there's the diversion of the money that is also causing suffering, you know, and on top of all of that, and I touched upon this in my presentation, this is an extremely energy-intensive form of depravity. The pollutants, I mean, once you stand beside one of these vehicles and you imagine on the battlefield how much energy it's consuming and the contaminants that they create, you know, through the explosives, the munitions and so forth, depleted uranium, these things are causing immense damage to the environment, which itself is having detrimental impacts on human health and causing people to die in large numbers. So,
and the military-industrial complex, the global military-industrial complex, where the United States way on top, is the largest source of greenhouse gases, you know, anywhere.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have all of these ways in which this industry is causing death and suffering, and by the way, also impeding the kind of international cooperation that we need to resolve the ecological crisis. We need an unprecedented level of cooperation. But military spending actually exacerbates tension and creates mistrust. So one cannot condemn this industry strongly enough. And I just want to say, as I was walking around, I thought some of the things that you are articulating now, you know, I imagine that a lot of these people in their personal lives are very decent people, that they genuinely care about their children and their spouses and their siblings and their parents and their friends and those who actually know them personally, find them to be decent human beings. But like, you know, Warnke, what I think they do is they compartmentalize, right? And they don't, they intentionally prevent themselves from contemplating the distant consequences of their behavior and only focus on their immediate world and just
mortgage their they mortgage their consciences and their souls to the institution of war.
Exactly. That's a much more eloquent way of putting it. I think that's precisely what they do.
Now, what's interesting, this took place in Qatar, and you pointed this out in your video that, you know, you think of Qatar as, you know, it's the country in the Middle East that kind of is, it kind of plays in all various ways and is kind of aligned with, it isn't aligned with, but it's, I don't know what's the correct word to describe it, but they're, you know, obviously people, Hamas has people in Doha, and, you know, Al Jazeera is based in Doha. So they're kind of seen, Qatar is kind of seen as straddling the, whatever it is, it's not the left-right divide or the north-south divide or whatever the capitalist people's divide, I don't know where, but you're saying that the largest U.S. base anywhere in the world is in Qatar. I'm not sure. Have you actually confirmed that?
Oh, yes. It's widely reported by so-called reputable sources in the West. It is, you know, widely acknowledged to be the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East, and it's huge. When you drive by it, as I did, I issued a separate report the next day. Because after I mentioned that, after I visited the exhibition hall, I drove out there. It's gigantic. And, you know, as I noted in my second report, that military base has been used for virtually every single U.S. war of aggression in the last 20 years. It was used in the Afghanistan war. It was used in the Iraq war. It was used to bombard Syria. It is being used today to maintain whatever nefarious military operations the U.S. is engaged in Iraq and in Afghanistan, which would be violations of the sovereignty of those countries. And, you know, so it is, I think, an inevitable impediment to the exercise of real sovereignty by the country of Qatar. But frankly, even without that military base, it would be very challenging for Qatar to maintain any amount of sovereignty in this part of the world, because it's a population of 2.8 million people. It's a small little peninsula. It's right smack dab in the middle of the Persian Gulf. It's got the Saudis on one side, the Iranians on the other, right across the water. They've been, up until recently, bitter enemies. They've got the UAE, Bahrain, military bases of the United States everywhere. And I think what they've tried to do basically is be everybody's friend. And one of the things I mentioned, you know, and I mentioned at the outset of this article and my piece, you know, a Russian destroyer came and was, as far as I could tell, the flagship exhibit at the naval, at the port where vessels of participating countries in DIMDEX had docked. So that, to me, plus the Iranians had a pavilion in the exhibition.
Tell me about and that. Tell me about the Gaza drone.
Yeah,
which was the Iran delegation's exhibits kind of prize. Yeah.
So they had the Iranian. So I just want, just to complete my point, I think that what I saw in that day was emblematic of the realities, the geopolitical realities that Qatar confronts. It's not in its interest to alienate any of its larger neighbors, any major country, because it's too small to defend itself. So it tries to be friends with everybody. But in terms of the Iranian pavilion, they had it, you know, in the furthest recesses of this gigantic hall. They, I think, quite intentionally kept it as far away as they could from the Western military contractors. They didn't have any huge weapons there. They had like little models all over the place. And I started strolling through their pavilion and I saw this drone, this rather small drone, which had the word Gaza on it. And so I asked a gentleman who was in a blue suit. He was obviously Iranian. I asked him to accompany me to the drone. I said, why does this drone bear the name of Gaza? And he smiled and he said, because the Iranian people love justice.
Yeah.
Did you take that? Do with that what you will. But that's what his answer was. I'm simply here to report to you what he said. But to be fair to him, okay, he didn't say the Iranian government. He said the Iranian people. And I do think that, as you know, that the Iranian people as a whole do genuinely desire justice for the people of Palestine. I don't think that was untrue.
Did you speak to anybody else there? Like, I was wondering whether or not you were going to sit down at some point and where they're serving coffee and ask anybody to just do some vox pop and ask people like why they're there and what they feel about it and what's it all about. And you didn't do that?
I didn't do that because I wanted to see the set. I thought the moment I started doing that, I was going to be at high risk of getting tossed out. And not only being tossed out, but having my accreditation revoked. And I needed my accreditation to see the warships. And so I decided at the end of the day, I debated that myself as I was walking around, whether I, you know, ambush somebody. But I decided that I wanted to keep my accreditation so that I could go to the port.
This would have been the perfect place for like somebody like Eve Engler to go through with his little body cam, kind of shouting, "You're murderers, you're murderers." And of course, I mean, you've done that on occasion, but I don't imagine you would have done that, unfurled that at the DIMDEX conference.
I think it would have ended up being a much less informative experience because I would have been removed from the premises in a good 30 seconds. The place was swarming with security and they weren't going to tolerate anything like that. As I say, I opted for the low-key approach.
How did you feel afterwards? Did you feel depleted? Did you feel depressed?
I felt like I needed to take a shower. I really did, because the whole thing was just quite, as I said at the outset of my video, it was creepy and slimy. That's how I felt about it. But at the end of the day, I was very happy to have had the opportunity to walk around that place unimpeded and to show people what goes on in one of these things, to give them a real glimpse. Because I think the vast majority of the public doesn't understand what goes on in the innards of the military industrial complex. And this was a very enlightening glimpse into the inner workings of that that terrible industry.
And one wonders whether or not these huge machines get purchased, right? Because people build them and they invest in them. Countries invest in these, and these are government, corporate, kind of collaborative ventures, and international. You know, the French and the Germans collaborating on some huge armored tank, and other systems that were foul. You know, this was a maritime conference. But one wonders, you know, who buys these things? Do they get sold?
Mm-hmm. Well, there at one point in my report, it was brief, but I went by a section that had been specifically reserved for the signing of MOUs. It was very ornate, and there was a podium and, you know, very large, comfortable, cushy chairs. And they were regularly scheduling throughout the conference the signings of, military deals. I suspect that a lot of those deals, if not all of them, get negotiated before the conference actually begins, and that's kind of just a way for people to brag about the fact that they made a deal, and tell potential buyers out there, you know, so-and-so has agreed to buy $500 million of our armored personnel carriers or whatever. But there are deals being made there. I think the other thing that goes on at these things, I can't warrant that this is the case, but it was my strong sense just from watching the way people were behaving. I think there's a lot of, mingling amongst decision makers in the foreign policy and military realm, and a lot of discussions taking place behind the scenes that actually end up having quite significant impacts on foreign policy and defense policy. I don't think that these conferences are just about buying and selling weapons. I think these are fora where decision makers in major militaries around the world and in government get together and hatch out their next nefarious plan, frankly. That's another reason why we need to keep our eyes very closely fixed on these types of events, because there are decisions being made, relationships being struck up, plans being hatched that have profound impacts on us all.
Now, let me ask you quickly, we only have about 6 minutes left here, but I'm wondering, did you see any equipment? I mean, one of the major emerging missions of naval forces these days around the world is dealing with migrants, people escaping wars and escaping environmental catastrophe and escaping environmental catastrophe that wars exacerbate. Did you see any equipment? And I know there are conferences about this and they talk about this. In Europe, there have been military conferences that are kind of billed as promoting surveillance and military technology aimed at dealing with this very problem, dealing with, you know, human migrants, people, refugees.
I didn't see any explicit appeals to, you know, initiatives to control refugee flows, migrant flows, but I saw vessels, which they were kind of like militarized speedboats. I saw quite a few of those. It was interesting. I mean, obviously, in that, as big as that exhibition hall was, you weren't going to fit any kind of naval vessel of any significance in that thing. But I didn't even see, you know, little models. There were models of lots of other types of weapons. They didn't have models of frigates and destroyers and aircraft carriers. What they had was these militarized kind of speedboats. Now, I don't know what those things serve, but they were obviously a popular item on that convention floor. And my guess is that one of the purposes to which those things is put is to track down, quote unquote, human smugglers on the high seas. If you're trying to race against a small boat and you're a destroyer, that may be difficult. But if you want to catch those migrants, you want to have, like, you know, a speedboat with a gun turret on it. And there was quite a bit of that. But I have to tell you, David, the one thing that really struck me about this conference really stood out for me. It was particularly striking because I was seeing this at a military exhibition that was supposed to be oriented towards maritime defense, is that there were drones all over the place. Almost everybody there was selling drones. The small manufacturers, the large manufacturers, there were drones for every imaginable purpose. And one of the things I've come to understand by paying close attention to the Ukraine war, to the battlefield, is that drones have revolutionized warfare, and they have made the destructive capacity of modern militaries much greater.
And I might add at that point that when I watch Al Jazeera reporting from Gaza, you know, you see an Al Jazeera reporter on the street in Gaza, you're constantly hearing drones overhead. So the people of Gaza, they've got drones overhead all the time, day and night.
Yeah. And when I was in South Lebanon twice last year, including after October 7th, and that was exactly the experience I had. The people of South Lebanon have constant droning overhead 24/7. It never stops. And that's the future of warfare. And it's horrifying.
Dimitri, let me just quickly ask you, we have about in 3 minutes, can you tell me about your trip to this Russian destroyer?
I showed up. They were giving tours to people, by the appearance of them, they were from Asia, from Southeast Asia. And I walked up to a gentleman who seemed to be the senior officer of the vessel. He was having a cigarette and he was standing at the bottom of the gangplank. And I asked him if I could do a tour. And he heard that I had a North American accent and he just politely said no. So I persisted and I said to him, look, I come from Canada, but I'm Greek. And I spent half the year in Greece. And he goes, oh, really? And so he started chatting with me. And then, after he got comfortable with me, he summoned a junior officer from the boat. I told him to come down and he introduced me to him and he said he directed him in Russian. I imagine that's what he said. He directed him to give me a tour of the ship. So I got on and he took me around this vessel. And this